Thank you. You all can be seated, thank you. So this afternoon, we have two cases on the docket, and the first one is called William B., I think is how you probably say it, versus the people. May I have your appearance, please?
Yeah, and your honor, Seth, that is our attorney, we have also put in my law clerk.
Welcome. Yes, counsel.
Good afternoon, your honor. It's Ryan Crane on behalf of the chief.
Gentlemen, you have a case which is supposed to last for 44 minutes. So you each have 22, and that means particularly you, counsel, Mr. Benzler, you need to calculate your time and watch so you can reserve some for rebuttal if you wish. All right? Whenever you're ready, sir.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. In Edwards v. Indiana, the Supreme Court held that the Constitution permits a state to limit a defendant's self-representation right by insisting upon representation by counsel at trial for those defendants who are competent to stand trial but suffer from a severe mental illness to the point where they are not competent to conduct trial proceedings by themselves. Every state that has considered the issue, with the exception of South Carolina, post Edwards, has held that the trial courts should exercise their Edwards discretion. Some of these courts have articulated specific standards for self-representation competency. None of these cases have deferred the matter to their respective legislatures to decide. The state in this case argues that the difficulty in formulating a standard for competency in the context of self-representation argues against this court adopting a specific standard. Instead, the state argues that the Colorado state legislature should take up the issue. First of all, the difficulty of formulating a standard is not a legitimate reason for failing to follow the Supreme Court's guidance in this matter. After all, the Supreme Court has stated that a higher standard should apply in the case of mentally ill defendants where there is an issue regarding self-representational competency.
Mr. Benezra, can I stop you there?
Of course.
Good afternoon. What would the standard be? What would our rule be that we would apply? What would you recommend if we did that?
Your Honor, I think one standard to consider is a standard that was set forth by both the Ninth Circuit and also the California Supreme Court. In the cases of United States versus Ferguson, it's 560 F3rd 1060, 2009 Ninth Circuit decision, and People versus Johnson, which is the California case, at 267 P3rd 1125. They both describe the standard as whether a defendant suffered from a severe mental illness which affected his ability to carry out the basic tasks needed to present his own defense without the help of counsel. The Johnson court went on to say there were a number of other standards that were discussed in law review articles and treatises, but it wasn't going to adopt those different standards. Rather, those standards could provide some guidance to the trial courts in terms of different factors that the trial courts might want to look at.
Can you help me? Because I got to say, as a former trial judge, I'm trying to picture how would I know when he's competent enough or not competent, just barely. You know what I mean? It's where do we go with that?
Right. I think one of the things that the California Supreme Court suggested was that if there is a doubt, if the trial court has a doubt, the trial court should appoint an expert to conduct an evaluation to determine whether or not the defendant is really capable of self-representation.
Which begs the question, who really is capable for self-representation? I mean, what I'm kind of getting at is I get concerned at the Edwards rule that as a former trial judge, I would also much rather have counsel than a pro se person, and trying to make that something that we can measure, they can measure. How would we measure that?
So again, it is very much up to the discretion of the trial court. It would be reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. The focus of these two cases is it's sort of a functional capability sort of issue. Does the person have the capacity to understand the basic trial tasks, to communicate, to understand that what's involved is opening statement, cross-examination of witnesses, etc.? that's the kind of issue, or whether or not that person's mental illness interferes with the ability to engage in those tasks.
Wait, so it'd be based on mental illness and not based on competency? Because,
yes.
For example, subpoenaing a witness, knowing hearsay, introducing exhibits, laying the foundation, would any of those come into play?
The person's capable abilities to do those things?
Right, because I can see that it would last a sort of a practical analysis of, could this person function in jury selection? Are they going to really get what they're doing?
Right. I mean, I think that there is a distinction in these cases that one can see as one's reading them between the defendant who is truly mentally ill and is acting in a truly bizarre way during self-representation, and somebody who simply doesn't have all of the skills that a trial lawyer is supposed to have. Obviously, self-representation is a bad idea for somebody who's completely competent. So, I mean, I think that's sort of a distinction. But what Edwards is talking about clearly is, as sort of a predicate, is that the defendant suffered from a severe mental illness. And Edwards identified a few of them, like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, both of which Mr. Bates suffered from, extreme anxiety, and there were some others, just as examples. So you would want that as sort of a predicate. It's not just somebody who...
So we would need some kind of a diagnosis. At the very least, we need an expert to do that.
I think that's likely. California strongly cautioned against not having an expert witness. I think that makes the most sense. It will be easier for the trial court judge to make an assessment with that kind of information. But again, it would be the discretion. In these two cases, anyway, it's in the discretion of the court, the trial court, as to whether or not that's needed.
All right. Thank you.
Could I stop you right there
on
the point about discretion? So since you say it's always within the discretion, I take it, though, you mean by that, given the remedy that you asked for, only that the judge has a range of choices that would be right, but he has to exercise that discretion, and if he makes the wrong choice outside that range, it's reversible error. Is that right?
Correct.
So it's not just that he could choose to take away the defendant's right to go pro se, but if he abuses his discretion in allowing the defendant to go pro se, he's equally subject to reversal. Is that right?
I think that's right. I mean, I think that's what these cases stand for, and I think that's what Edwards is basically saying. The trial court needs to consider the situation, needs to make findings of fact with respect to the particular defendant so that it's reviewable by the appellate court. All of that assumes that there will be review, an abuse of discretion sort of review. And if that review reveals that discretion was abused, then it's reversible.
And just one follow-up. So aside from the, I understand you're saying it's a discretion, so there's not exactly one right answer, there's a range. But apart from the fact that there's a range rather than one right answer, is that any different from saying Indiana v. Edwards created a new and different and third standard, a different standard for competence for purposes of a defendant going pro se?
You're asking if there's a difference between this abuse of discretion issue and Edwards creating a third heightened standard?
So in effect, is that tantamount to saying you think you read Edwards to mean it created a different competence standard from Dusky?
I do read it that way. I don't think you can read it any other way. The court specifically states that there is a higher standard, that Dusky is not enough. And that's at page 177 to 78 of the Edwards decision. The court is actually saying the question of mental competency for self-representation calls for a different standard than the question of mental competency for the assistance of counsel.
Does that implicitly overrule, then, Ferretta?
Your Honor, I don't think so. Ferretta was a case that did not involve a mentally incompetent defendant. In Ferretta, the defendant was somebody who was competent. I think the words that the court used were he was lucid, he was articulate, etc. So I don't think there was a rule for Ferretta. The issue of self-representational competency was not an issue in Ferretta. Mental competency was not an issue. And I think, and in Edwards, the Edwards court specifically stated that it's not appropriate for that.
I said one more follow-up, but let me ask one other response to your question. Well, but to the extent that Ferretta seems to say, you have a constitutional right to represent yourself as long as you waive counsel. Does this not conflict with that? Or do you think this standard of competence, in effect, modified the standard of effective waiver of your right to counsel?
I think, Your Honor, that it modified.
Okay.
In the unique situation of a seriously mentally ill defendant who's seeking to self-represent, I think that standard has been modified.
Counsel, I'm sorry, if I could turn up on that train of thought. I guess what I'm wrestling with is, in the posture of Edwards, at least the language you use seemed to suggest the state could deny self-representation, in other words, sort of force a posting defendant to take counsel under certain narrow circumstances, where we have concerns about their mental illness and where it looks like the defendant is incapable of performing the basic tasks of carrying out his defense. And I guess I'm wondering if we're trying to square that with Ferretta, if what was really going on there is a suggestion that once we get past the waiver, a valid waiver, we have a sort of a default assumption that you are entitled to proceed pro se. And then the only way we take that away from you then is under these narrow circumstances. So that Edwards is really looking at the narrow circumstances in which that might be taken away, as opposed to adding yet another hurdle to permit the defendant to proceed pro se. And I'm just wondering if how that strikes you.
I think that is a difficult issue. One of the things that the California Supreme Court said in People versus Johnson was that the court did not have to, in every case, conduct an Edwards analysis. That there could be cases where, in fact, it did not appear to the court that the court had any doubt with respect to competency for self-representation. So the distinction seems to be drawn in some of these cases that come up post Edwards. I think that what's good about the standard in Ferguson and in California is that what it says basically is that if the court has a doubt, then the court should consider this. And
or that it may, right? I mean, is it?
Well, I think it's stronger than that under Edwards. I think that it's not just a permissive standard. I know that the state has argued that it's a permissive standard. I don't think it's a permissive standard. I think it's something that the court, if it believes that there's an issue, really has to exercise its discretion in those situations. The permitted to language that appears in Edwards, where it says the states are permitted to impose counsel.
Right, in other words, without violating or trampling rights under that.
But I think that that's somewhat unfortunate language and should be considered in the context of the case and what the issue was in that particular case. The state had imposed counsel, and what the court was simply saying was that it was permitted to do so under these circumstances. And not that it's permissive, but simply that it was certainly permitted to do so. I don't know if I'm articulating that very well, but it's not, I don't think that's exactly the holding of the case. I think Edwards is really saying that there is, in fact, a higher standard. The Ferguson-Johnson standard that we're talking about is relatively straightforward. It leaves the discretion of the trial judge, who is in the very best position to make a determination about self-representational competency. It also focuses directly on the severity of the mental illness and the ability of the defendant to carry out trial tasks. The state's argument that the court should wait for the legislature to act should be rejected. After all, Edwards was decided 6 years ago, and there is no indication that the Colorado legislature has or will take up this issue. Moreover, this court has a general superintending authority over the lower courts of the state under Article 6, Section 2 of the Colorado Constitution, which requires that this court make and promulgate rules governing the administration of all courts and governing practice and procedure in civil and criminal cases. Under this provision, this court has adopted the rules, the Colorado Rules of Criminal Procedure, to defer to the state legislature when there is no indication whatsoever that the legislature is presently considering the issue would constitute a failure to exercise this important responsibility. Furthermore, this court is simply better equipped to address the constitutional issues of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, the right to self-representation, and the right to fair trial from its years of adjudicating constitutional issues than is the legislature. The state also asserts Mr. Beatty was not a gray area defendant that required a competency evaluation under Edwards. Because there was no Dusky competency evaluation in this case, the people base its argument for competency on Beatty's trial performance. They say that Mr. Beatty articulated a logical theory of the defense that consistently advanced the trial. The state argues that Mr. Beatty's admission that he beat his girlfriend in the past, that he used drugs, that he committed the crimes of intimidating and tampering with the victim witness, but did not do so in this case, but during the previous case, are all self-deprecating and part of a grand defense theory. These arguments should be rejected. The history of this case is, in fact, riddled with questions regarding Mr. Beatty's self-representational competency, an issue that the trial court ultimately never seems to have considered. On April 17, 2009, Mr. Beatty asked the court for a new attorney. The trial court dismissed the public defender. 4 days later, on April 21st, Mr. Beatty asked that his PD be reappointed. Beatty told the court that when he fired his lawyer, he was not on his medication that day. When I don't take medication, I somehow think that I am a super smart guy, that I can do things that I normally would not do on my medication. I am bipolar schizophrenic. In response, the court indicated that it was clearly aware of his mental health problems. The court said, Mr. Beatty, calm down. Don't let your anxiety get to you. On May 8th of 2009, the PD indicated that he had received 100 pages of handwritten material from Mr. Beatty, which raised serious concerns in the public defender's mind about Mr. Beatty's mental health. The PD asked that he be allowed extra time to consider whether or not he should convert Mr. Beatty's not guilty plea to a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity or impaired mental condition. Although the defendant did not ultimately change his plea, the defense counsel made it known to the trial court that he was exploring this issue as further evidence of Mr. Beatty's mental illness. On the first day of trial, November 4th of 2009, Beatty again fired his lawyer. Beatty told the court completely inconsistently with what he had said on April 21st of 2009, that when he wanted, that when he decided to accept counsel on April 21st, he was not on his medication. Mr. Beatty also said, that when he decided to accept counsel on April 21st, he was not on his medication, when he had said that he was previously. Mr. Beatty also said he wanted to and was ready to represent himself, even though he had not developed a subject in the case. The court gave an advisement under Arguello, and despite fairly comprehensive warnings to Mr. Beatty about the risk of proceeding pro se, the record does not make even a single mention of his competency to do so. The court simply never considered the issue. His performance at trial also raises competency issues. In addition to second-degree assault against his girlfriend, which was alleged to have occurred on September 8, 2008, Mr. Beatty was charged with intimidating and tampering with witnesses by writing letters to his girlfriend and her mother from the Baltimore County Jail in September and October of 2008. Mr. Beatty's defense regarding the letters was he wrote the letters in 2001, or maybe 2005, to dissuade the very same victims in this case from pursuing charges against him in a previous assault case. In other words, the defense was, I did the crime in 2001 or 2005, but not in 2008. The letters were themselves marked as being written in September or October of 2008. The letters were clearly postmarked from 2008. One of the letters was written to Mr. Beatty's son. Mr. Beatty testified that he wrote the letter in 2001, which the DA pointed out in cross-examination was prior to the birth of his child. There were many problems during this trial. Mr. Beatty never objected, and Mr. Beatty repeatedly interrupted witnesses. Mr. Beatty had emotional outbursts and had to be counseled about that by the trial judge. Mr. Beatty elicited from both the victim and the mother that he was a violent person. But perhaps most telling of the jury instructions, Mr. Beatty was charged with second-degree assault, class 4 felony. The charge required proof of a specific intent to cause bodily injury. But the trial court did not discuss defenses to the second-degree assault charge during their Arguello advisements or during trial. That, for example, intoxication or heat of passion could result in the conviction of a lesser felony or perhaps a misdemeanor. There was evidence that Mr. Beatty was intoxicated at the time of the incident. That evidence had actually been introduced by the state. The court offered to give all of these instructions, lesser included, intoxication, heat of passion instruction to the jury, telling Mr. Beatty that he thought the evidence in the case that had been submitted at trial supported the giving of the instructions. Mr. Beatty refused the instructions. and stated that he did not understand them. The trial court made no effort to explain the instructions to Mr. Beatty and did not give them to the jury. This series of events raises serious questions about whether or not Mr. Beatty was in fact convicted of the right crimes. He was convicted of second-degree assault as a class 4 felony. Perhaps if these instructions had been given, if he had been competent to self-represent or had counsel, he would have been convicted of a lesser assault charge.
Could I ask you a question about that?
Yes.
I mean, you can make a persuasive case about that looking backwards. How is a trial judge supposed to be able to make these kinds of determinations prospectively? And an expert should be able to come in, I guess, is going to be your answer and suggest a likelihood or a probability. But one doesn't really know what's going to happen at trial until you're in trial, as you well know. And I've personally experienced defendants who had that exact problem of being medicated into competency, dropping off of their medicine, no longer being competent, et cetera, and kind of going in and out of competency almost, if you will. What's your response to all of that?
Those are difficult situations for the trial judge, I acknowledge. But trial judges have to deal with these problems with competency for competency to proceed to trial represented. That can happen in the middle of trial. It has happens all the time. And so we have sort of this similar situation here where the trial judge may have to take a pause in the proceedings, may have to consult with or bring the expert in that they originally had to reevaluate the defendant. All of those things may have to happen.
So do you anticipate, say the judge decides that the defendant is competent, and then things happen during trial that would suggest otherwise. Is that a mistrial? Is that reversible? Has Jeopardy attached? And what kinds of problems do you anticipate that the trial judge might be looking at?
I think all of those problems. I mean, I think under the circumstances of a defendant who has competency problems in the middle of trial and is not restored to competency, the likely result will be a mistrial. Time would be spent either restoration to competency, after in this case, with a new trial and counsel being appointed to represent.
Thank you.
Is there any remaining time I have?
48 seconds. Go fast. All right. Mr. Crane.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. The state has argued that we do not agree the court should adopt a higher standard of competency under Edwards. And the first reason that's true in this case really is that the facts don't require it. Edwards does not require, or and it certainly doesn't empower states to take on some sort of new competency standard that require trial courts to exercise discretion in this new area. What it does is, first of all, it only applies in cases where a defendant was denied the right of self-representation, and that didn't occur here. The defendant here was competent under Dusty. He also normally intelligently waived counsel. I know that they dispute that, but assuming that is the case, there's no question under Edwards that the constitutional requirements of the U.S. Constitution were fulfilled. It's also the case that the Colorado Constitution guarantees in the same way the right to self-representation. In fact, this court in Arguello said that the Colorado Constitution reinforces that right of self-representation, and therefore, for this court to say trial courts now need to start exercising discretion in this new area, it would have to hold that the Colorado Constitution also has this exception that the U.S. Supreme Court rendered to the U.S. Constitution's guarantee of self-representation in Edwards. The reasons we're arguing were generally that the court should not adopt a standard, besides the fact that it's not necessary in this case at all, is that there are very many risks and unknowns, and there are very few benefits. Specifically, there are few benefits for the reason that the defendants we're talking about here are competent under Dusty. They have a rational, factual understanding of the proceedings. And under Arguello, we've assured that they have a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver of counsel before they proceed. What Godinez made clear is that the competence requires that companies can break the waiver right. And that's what we need to be focused on. We can feel good about the fact that we are protecting defendants' right to exercise their own, to exercise their autonomy, their decision that, yes, I understand these proceedings, yes, I'm competent, and I understand what it means to proceed without a lawyer. I'm making that choice. We don't need to step into this quagmire of risks and questions to say, but we also want to take that right away from these defendants in certain circumstances. In Barnes, the South Carolina Supreme Court, for the same reason, citing the supplemental authorities, said, we don't think public policy encourages us to do this or supports us doing that. The risk, of course, is if the trial court is deemed to have gotten it wrong, out of necessity, the court has violated the defendant's forever his right to represent himself. Automatic reversal. It would be the same, I think, if the Court of Appeals or this court adopted some standard that would later deem incorrect by the U.S. Supreme Court, for example. Those cases would have then been wrongly decided in hindsight. And trial courts don't run any risk in allowing the defendant to go forward after ensuring just competence and ensuring a knowing and intelligent waiver of counsel. There's no risk of violating the Constitution by allowing this defense to go forward. It's essentially the same concerns we have in almost any pro se case that the defendant might do a really bad job at trial. And as judges and attorneys, we're in this business because we care about justice, and those are things that we are concerned about, and think rightfully so. But there isn't a reason to then say we need to start prohibiting defendants from exercising this right because we are concerned that they might not do a good job. That's a decision that was made in Ferretta and that this court has echoed, is supported by the Colorado Constitution.
Could I interrupt you one second there?
Yes, sir.
What do you make of the line in the majority opinion where they say, in Edwards, where they say, Ferretta does not answer the question before us because it did not consider the problem of mental competency. Does that suggest that when they said, if you make an effective waiver of your right to counsel, that you have a right to go pro se, that does not apply, and that the court in Edwards is narrowing Ferretta to mean it did not apply to mental incompetence?
It's hard to square that with the statement that we're not overruling Ferretta, but I think one way to look at it is Ferretta does guarantee this right of self-representation, but there are certain areas where it doesn't violate the Constitution for a court to say, but in this narrow circumstance, I'm going to stop it for some other reason that's important. I don't know if I can fully reconcile the statement.
Let me follow up with just one question.
Yes.
Mr. Benazra, you used the term discretion, but this was discretionary, and I wanted to ask, when you say, in effect, it's like a ratchet, it only goes in one direction. You're always safe if you allow the defendant to go pro se, as long as he made a waiver. It's only if you don't,
right,
there's a question. Normally, if we characterize something as discretionary, it doesn't mean it's a freebie and you get to do what you want, right? It means if you're outside the range, in either direction, you're reversed.
Right.
Would you say Indiana v. Edwards then does not create a discretionary standard, or how would you square your interpretation?
I think the decision is clear. It certainly doesn't grant states or state courts any inherent power to exercise discretion. What it says is, if you do this, states, it doesn't violate the U.S. Constitution, but it certainly doesn't require any exercise of discretion. It just says, in the case that a state deprives a defendant in this narrow category of self-representation, it doesn't violate its forever right in this very narrow circumstance. It doesn't grant courts, or it certainly doesn't require courts or states to exercise any kind of discretion. Otherwise, we wouldn't have decisions like the South Carolina case, where the court said, we're not adopting this higher standard of Edwards. We don't think it furthers public policy. We've already got it. And I would argue, Colorado, we have an exhaustive and I think thorough and proper scheme of evaluating competency. I mean, we allow and provide for multiple competency evaluations for defendants because we do care about this issue.
And this court has, has created a very thorough advisement in our way. So we've got all those things in place to protect defendants. It is unnecessary to now impose another standard, another test, and another area for defendants to say, wait, you should have forced counsel on me, even though I know I intelligently waived my right to go to have counsel, and even though I was competent to do so, I want a new trial because you should have forced counsel on me. And I'm not even sure what the basis of authority would be to reverse a conviction in that case, other than maybe Mr. Fenezer has cited maybe the court's kind of supervisory authority. I know some case law indicates that to be exercised only really in just extraordinary circumstances.
Excuse me, is there something, for example, that could be added to the Arguello advisement that might address this kind of thing in the courtroom? I know that Arguello asks an awful lot of questions, and we don't know exactly what it is that Indiana versus Edwards wants us to address further. But you seem to be suggesting that Arguello goes almost all the way there. What doesn't it do?
I mean, I think conceptually they're different in the sense that Edwards really is trying to carve out this narrow exception for competency issues that really, I mean, it limits itself explicitly to severe mental illness. Because of that, you can't even perform these basic trial tasks.
But the person could, I guess, ostensibly pass the Arguello advice, right?
All of it is very theoretical, I agree, and so I guess conceptually there is the idea that a person could, you know, have the, even without the variation of competence over time that you referred to, a person could pass Dusty, pass Arguello, and still, you know, maybe they hear voices only in certain circumstances, and then because of that they can't cross-examine the witnesses.
I guess it's still what we're most worried about.
I'm sorry?
Well, it's exactly what you're saying, but still X. So what I want to know is what that is. And you know, do you say, one, you probably wouldn't say because the Edwards case did seem to explicitly eliminate, quote, technical ability, I think they called it, something
right.
like that, technical skills.
Right.
So you wouldn't want to say something like, well, explain hearsay to me.
Right, but, you wouldn't want
but
to.
But what would you say? How would you, we've been working on learning and this afternoon trying to figure out what it is you would say.
I don't think it can be just in the nature of an advisement because it's more like a competency evaluation where you're trying to get
but like a super competency evaluation.
I guess. I mean, a competency evaluation that requires a mock trial where the person can practice skills and show the court he can really do it. You know, I don't know. That's why, you know, we have these. You know,
well, I just have one more question. Sorry
yes.
to interrupt. You know, your opposing counsel made reference to the California Supreme Court and their idea that there be an expert. And you're familiar with that case, of course?
Yes.
So what kind of expert is that? Is it another doctor or is it a trial expert?
I assume it's another medical professional because we're talking about, Edwards seems to speak of things in the same nature that we, as Dusty did, and that we think of it in our competency evaluations. I think that's problematic because, as noted, the Colorado Common, maybe it's not, I haven't noted it, but the Colorado Constitution statutes allow for competency exams when Dusty competence is in question. When a person doesn't have rational and factual understanding of the proceedings, it doesn't grant trial courts any procedure or authority to order competency evaluations based on Edwards' concerns. So a trial court who gets a defendant who, after a competency evaluation, decides I'm going to go pro se, can't order a new evaluation to address that issue. And that leaves trial courts in a difficult position in some of these cases, because a lot of times, like in this case, in at least one of the other four cases being heard today, the defendant at the time of trial decided I'm going to go pro se and made the decision to do so at that time. If the court doesn't have further questions on that, I can address the Arguello issue briefly. And the cert grant, of course, is all whether the trial court substantially complied. You know, our response is yes, the court substantially complied. It went through all 14 points of our Guido. And they gave responsive answers. He demonstrated his ability to understand the proceedings. And his own education and familiarity with prior legal proceedings made him, in fact, better suited than most pro se defendants, I would say, to go forward pro se at trial. You know, did he get cut off in time? Did he get, you know, argumentative and say, nothing really bizarre, but he said things at times that were inappropriate, but really conducted himself as well as any pro se defendant that I've read before. His theory of the case was consistent. Yes, he mentioned that, you know, he had abused the victim in one prior case, but that was, he only had so much to work with. He had written these letters from the jail, multiple letters saying basically, here's what I did, but I drank a lot of tequila, don't testify against me, basically. He didn't have a lot to work with. What he did is he came up with what he had and said, you know what, those actually related to a prior case. They forged the dates and changed them. So I admit I did, as I said, no matter abuse the victim once in the past, but you know, I'm not gonna lie to you guys. I'm gonna be honest with you. I've had drinking problems, I've had drug problems, but that's not what happened here. And this is all stuff in the past. I mean, I don't know what a lawyer would have done a whole lot differently given the facts against him. So the fact that his, you know, defense admitted some negative facts, those were things that were really in evidence. He had no other way to contradict them other than weave them into a theory of defense, which he did. And he did it in a way to try to kind of engender sympathy and say, look, I'm going to be honest with you guys. I've done this in the past. I'm not perfect, but here's what happened here. And so the fact that he made a brief comment at the instruction conference does not outweigh the fact that he made proper, appropriate, responsive answers at the time of the advisement, and the trial court hit all the points that Arguello requires and ensured what happened here, which is a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver of counsel. And if the court has no further questions, I'll ask that the decision be affirmed.
All right, thank you very much. You do have a little bit of time left. I'd like you to answer the question that I asked Mr. Crane, because I've been trying to think about what this expert would look like. And if, is it in your reading and understanding just another psychiatrist, or what is this person doing that's different than in a competency examination?
I think it's very similar. I think it is a psychiatrist or a psychologist looking at, first of all, whether or not the person is suffering from a severe mental illness, and then what kind of effect that might have on the person's ability to communicate in the context of a trial and to perform those basic trial tasks. I don't think it requires an expert on trials. It's really a mental health expert.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We appreciate counsel's argument and assistance today.